You're with John Cleary on ABC Local Radio and on Radio Australia.
The sound of the Penderith Male Choir with Mafanwi. It's a selection of our guests. Let me introduce him to you. Professor John Lennox, an Oxford scientist and mathematician who has taken up the debate on the current crop of pop atheists, including Dawkins and Hitchens, to debate the contentious matters of science and God. And John Lennox is our guest this evening, and this is one of his favourites. Dr. John Lennox is a professor of mathematics and fellow in the philosophy of science at Oxford University. He's our guest on Sunday night, but more particularly he's been in Australia over the last few weeks debating that vexed question of science and God. Is it science or God? Is it science and God? Is it science versus God? John Lennox is going to help us sort a few of those issues out. John Lennox, welcome to Sunday Night.
Thank you very much. Delighted to be with you.
John Mafanwi, we had a male voice choir. Your accent, though, tells me you're Irish. We started with a Welsh male voice choir.
Well,
just why, in passing?
Because my children would never let me get away with something that wasn't Welsh. We lived in Wales for nearly 30 years and my three children are all Welsh.
What led you, a professor of mathematics, to become interested in a debate over the existence of God?
Well, I've always been interested in it. When I turned up at Cambridge in 1962, one of the first questions I was asked as an undergraduate was a student said to me, "Do you believe in God?" And then he apologised. He said, "Oh, sorry, I forgot you're Irish. You all believe in God and you fight about it." And although I'd heard the question before, that provided an intellectual challenge. Here, on the one hand, I was studying an intellectually respectable subject like mathematics, a really hard subject. On the other hand, could I be content with a faith that was simply a product of Irish heredity and environment, kind of Irish genetics? And so what I decided to do, on that day, I remember it very clearly, was to befriend people who didn't share my worldview, and in particular, look out for atheists. And I've essentially been doing that ever since, and finding out about their worldview and comparing it with my own and testing the strength of the arguments and trying to be vulnerable about my own arguments. Because if one believes in God and cannot open that up to investigation, then the belief must be very shaky.
What led you to a conviction about God? That is, we all are born into cultures which are, to some extent, religious or not religious. At some point, we have to wrestle with our own understanding of God.
Oh, absolutely. I was born in a family in Northern Ireland. My parents were Christian, but they were very remarkable. They allowed me to think, and they were not sectarian. Let's put it this way, they hated the drums no matter who played them. And my father tried to be a fair-minded man in employing people across both sides of the community. And I'm so thankful for that, because I didn't grow up with the kind of sectarian baggage and the bitterness and the hatred. My father, for example, was so enlightened in that sense that when I was 14, he handed me a copy of the Communist Manifesto. And he said, you ought to read that, to try to see what these other people think. So my conviction has grown really through engagement, through interaction, and through discovering that my faith in God had enormous explanatory power and was also giving me an insight and satisfactory answers as time went on to the really deep questions of life. And I didn't find those answers in atheism.
Paul Tillich famously described God as the ground of our being. In another sense, he's also talking about that around which things cohere. Is coherence the best thing for you? That is, this is the way it makes best sense.
Well, I think that's part of it. When we think of truth, and that's what interested me, is Christianity true, not is it helpful, and so on. I think we have two basic theories of truth from a philosophical point of view. We have the correspondence theory of truth. If a thing is true, it ought to correspond to reality. But then there's coherence, the coherence test for truth. Does it hang together? And C.S. Lewis, whom I just caught, incidentally, in 1962, I heard his last lectures. He makes the point that I believe in God just as I believe in the sun, not so much because I see it. It's actually dangerous to look at it directly, but because in its light, I see everything else. And that explanatory power, that coherence for me is a very important thing.
You're on Sunday Night on ABC Radio. John Cleary with you. My guest, Professor John Lennox, visiting Sydney as part of the continuing debate about God. John Lennox, let's have another piece of music. One of the great expressions of institutional religion, cultural religion, religion in every sense, still lives with us and is sung in almost every house across the land. At a certain point every year, somebody will whistle a bit of it, is Handel's The Messiah.
That's
of
right.
Of course, the great element of The Messiah isn't that it's just got this sort of cultural hold on us and still continues to have, but for you, of course, it's Irish.
Well, yes, it is, and I think we ought to explain that. Handel actually had the first performance of The Messiah in Dublin, and although I'm a Northern Irishman, I still count Dublin as part of Ireland.
And it was for the benefit of a children's charity.
That's right, that's right. And it is a marvellous expression of song. I think actually one of the evidences, not the only one, of course, of the truth of Christianity is that it creates art, it creates music, it is an impetus for great imaginative works. And if there's a creator there who is ultimately responsible for the human mind, somehow that's part of the coherent story.
Thank you.
handle. You're on Sunday night on ABC Radio Around Australia. John Cleary with you, my guest, Professor John Lennox. John Lennox, let's talk about the issues that we raised just before, that inspirational piece of music, The Hard Edge. Hitchens and others have come out in the last couple of years with a fairly aggressive assault on the whole notion of God. There seem to be two or three core arguments, and there are various strands to these arguments, but the arguments boil down to two or three. That God is no longer necessary to explain the intricacy and design of the universe. The God hypothesis, the God of the gaps, is no longer necessary. The second argument is that morality no longer needs God, that we can have a perfectly rational, atheistic morality that doesn't require God. And the third idea flows from those two, and that is that Occam's razor says, therefore, God is no longer necessary. Let's begin with the first one, or let's begin with the way you approach those arguments. Would you agree, first of all, that they're the major strands of the
arguments? Oh, they are. I think there's perhaps a prior thing. And Dawkins, in a recent interview in Der Spiegel, a German magazine, said that 9/11 radicalized him. And I think that militant edge that you refer to has come in because something has snapped. That is, this is unacceptable religion. It's fanatical, admitted. But fanatical religion thrives at the edge of moderate religion, so all religion's got to go. How are we going to get rid of it?
So there's a rhetorical argument there, really, emotional. Yes.
But they want to use the cultural authority of science to get rid of religion, and hence your analysis, I think, is correct.
This approach has a long history. I mean, Huxley began this approach 100 years ago. Darwin's bulldog, he was called for no unimportant reason, and that he used science as a way of driving religion out of public education, or wanted to use it.
That's correct. Now, yes.
So there's a long history to this argument. Let's talk about the merits of it. Let's talk about the merit of science now has the explanatory power to push God not only to the margins, but out of the equation.
Well, I think that's completely wrong-headed thinking, actually. And where I would want to start here is just the facts of history. Science exploded in the 16th and 17th century in a Christian culture. Now, people have analysed why there and why then. And the consensus of opinion is very interesting because it's agreed on not simply by Christian philosophers, but far more interestingly, by atheist philosophers. And that is this: men became scientific because they expected law in nature, and they expected law in nature because they believed in a lawgiver. One of your most distinguished ancient historians here in Sydney is Professor Edwin Judge at Macquarie. And he says quite clearly, in agreement with these other people like Sir Alfred North Whitehead, that it was the Christian biblical notion of the rationality of the Creator who'd created rational human beings that gave rise to the deep-seated possibility that you could do science.
Indeed, there's a Jewish argument there too, isn't there? The whole notion of the arrow in time comes
out of
a Jewish understanding of the world rather than a cyclical Greco-Roman understanding.
Absolutely. This is the Judeo-Christian heritage, and Genesis starts it off. And I would want to start there because it helps now clear up some of the misunderstandings. Newton, for example, believed in God. He discovered the law of gravity. But what he didn't say was, now I've got a mechanism, I don't need God. He had the sense to see that mechanism and agency are not competing concepts. In fact, he did the opposite. He wrote the most brilliant book of the history of science called Principia Mathematica, with the dedication at the beginning to persuade the thinking man that there is a God. Because Newton's attitude was not God of the gaps. Now I understand it. I've got gravitation. I don't need God. But what a marvellous God that did it that way. Now, I think the new atheists are running up a blind alley by setting God, the agency, and science, which discusses the mechanisms, as competing elements. They don't even belong to the same category. So from a philosophical perspective, they're making a very elementary category mistake.
And they would respond, well, if you're going to posit at the beginning of all this a designer, then that is simply a way of getting around another question, which can be exposed by saying, well, who designed the designer? that yes, you're in an infinite regression.
Yes, they do say that. I used to hear that from schoolboys and Russian academics. But the very interesting thing about that is this. Who made God? That's basically the question, you see. But now, it's very interesting when you start to analyse it. Firstly, if you ask the question, who made God? You are, by definition, thinking of a created God. Now, Richard Dawkins recently wrote a book called The God Delusion, in which he uses this as his major argument. If he'd called it the created God's delusion, I don't think he'd have made a lot of money, because most of us have known for centuries that created gods are a delusion. But let me drill into it a bit more thoroughly. You see, he believes that the universe created him. So let's turn the argument back on him and ask him, logically, if he's going to ask me the question, who created God, I'm going to ask him the question, who created the universe? But he won't allow that question. Why? Because he appears, although I'm not quite sure, I couldn't get him to answer it in my debate with him. He appears to believe that the universe, matter, energy, are eternal. Ah, but now he's given the game away, because he now believes in something eternal. If you ask the question, who created God, it shows that you cannot conceive of anything eternal. But the biblical revelation of God is that God is not created. He is eternal. The buck stops there. And it's very fascinating to me, in fact it's amusing, that Dawkins lives in great hope of a so-called TOE, a theory of everything, where the buck stops. So you see, they're inconsistent. They think the buck can stop somewhere, but not in God. And to sum that up, I would say this. There are two worldviews that are diametrically conflicting here. It's not science and religion conflicting. Not at all. The Human Genome Project, its first director was an atheist, Jim Watson. Its second director, Francis Collins, an evangelical Christian. Their science, brilliant. I see the conflict as not between science and religion at all. It's between two worldviews, atheism and theism, and there are scientists on both sides. So, in the question you asked, the buck stops somewhere. With the atheist, it stops in the universe or the multiverse. For the Christian like myself, it stops in God. So we both got to stop. The question is, what way does the evidence point?
That gets to another question, of course, is whether there is any evidentiary way of getting to God.
Oh, certainly. I'd be a fool to believe in God if there wasn't any evidence.
But the evidence is not of a scientific sort.
Some of it is.
Some of it is?
Yes, yeah, certainly. Of course it is.
Give me an example of what you would say.
I've just started giving you one. The very fact that we can do science, for me, is one of the greatest evidences. I mean, think about it. Every scientist has a faith. Sometimes we hear faith as a religious concept that's not worth talking about. But in fact, scientists have faith. Einstein pointed it out. He couldn't imagine a scientist without this faith. In what? The rational intelligibility of the universe. And my teacher of quantum physics at Cambridge, Professor Sir John Polkinghorne, puts it this way. Physics is powerless to explain its belief in the rational intelligibility of the universe. Why? Because you've got to believe it before you do any physics at all. But now, let's look at that fundamental belief that's essential to all scientists, whether they're atheists or not, in the light of these two worldviews. What does atheism tell me? It tells me there's no transcendence, there's no top-down causation, there's no God. There's just matter and energy. And the human mind is simply the human brain. The human brain is the product of an unguided, mindless, natural process. And as philosophers are beginning to see, notably one of the world's top philosophers, Alvin Plantinga, that then means that the cognitive apparatus, how can we trust it? Where does the validity of thinking come from? Haldane, years ago, a chemist who was not a Christian, I think an atheist, he said, if the thoughts in my mind are simply the random motions of atoms in my brain, why should I believe any theories they develop, including the one that my mind's composed of atoms? Now, just to finish that, therefore, to my mind, the atheistic worldview undermines the rationality for science. But going back to why science exploded in the 16th and 17th century, the Christian worldview makes perfect sense. The reason we can do science is that the same God who's responsible for the universe is ultimately responsible for the human mind. That's one of the most powerful evidences to me. Pointers from science that there is a God.
Which brings us back to coherence.
Yes, it does. Absolutely. It's not a proof in the mathematical sense, but you only get that in mathematics. You don't even get it in natural science. You get evidences, inferences.
Intimations. You're on Sunday night on ABC Radio around Australia. John Cleary with you. We're talking about intimations of the divine with John Lennox on Sunday night. Another great intimation of the divine is music. Another piece of music from that you've selected for us, John Lennox, is Nella Fantasia. Tell us why.
Well, simply because I like it. It's a wonderful example of the tenor voice, and Russell Watson has a magnificent voice. I think the content of the song is quite interesting because it's talking about a person in whose imagination people are free. So it's an expression of the longing of the human heart for freedom. But I simply like it because it gives expression to such a range of the power of a really good tenor voice.
Sempre libere, come le nave
on Sunday night. Nulla Fantasia, and it's a selection of our guest, John Lennox. John Lennox is in Sydney and around Australia to take part in a series of debates and public lectures on science, religion, and the new atheism. Dawkins, Hitchens are his daily consumption at the moment. John Lennox, let's talk for a moment about the other dimension of the against God debate. We've dealt briefly with the physical stuff.
Mm-hmm.
There is another side to this debate, which says the explanatory power of religion, not just in the area of science, but in the area of morality, is overwhelming. That is, there needs to be some sort of coherent order to the moral universe, and this is best explained via some notion like God, the ultimate determiner of morality. Counter to that is an argument that says this world is shaped in such a way and moral order progresses in such a way that if we are to pose God as a designer, he's got to be a pretty nasty sort of God, a God that would allow innocent suffering, a God that would allow babies to be born deformed. This is not a benign creator. This is either a mischievous or a very dark and evil God.
Well, you're asking a whole series of questions there, and they're very important questions. In fact, they're so important to me that a few years ago I decided to drop out for a year and do a degree in bioethics so that I could get into this debate, the status of human life, and so on and so forth. And I think the first thing I would want to say to you about this is that the question as to the foundations of ethics is central. And the new atheists are outraged by the kind of thing you mention. Now, right up front, I will admit to you that the hardest question I face as a Christian is the question of suffering, of deformed babies, and all of that. Let me admit that. That's the hardest question. I've been in Auschwitz many times, and I've always wept. So that's a real question to me, a real hard question.
And let's make the distinction here too. One can easily, and it's been dealt with theologically for centuries, develop an argument about the human agency in causing evil as an extension of the argument about free will.
That's
absolutely
right.
We're not talking about that. We're talking about evil which seems to be inherent in the structure of the universe. That is, when an earthquake kills thousands or when a child is born deformed.
Right.
It's that uncaused evil, in a sense.
Mm-hmm. It's usually called the problem of pain, as distinct from the problem of evil. My approach to it is this, and I would say I have no simplistic answers. I don't think there are simplistic answers. But let's suppose that it is a powerful argument for getting rid of God. So there is no God. So that's it. That's just how the universe is. So we've solved the intellectual problem. But we haven't removed the suffering. And we have removed all hope. So I want to rephrase the question. I do believe in God, so I have the problem. Are there any grounds for seeing a glimmer of hope in all of this? And I do believe that there are. You see, central to the Christian faith, and I've thought about this a lot because I've had to sit with people who have faced these things, both human evil and pain. Central to the Christian faith is the fact that the claim that God came into this world in the person of Jesus Christ, who died on a cross. Now, many people think this is all mythology, but just let's try to think our way into it. Just suppose for a moment that this is true, that that's God on a cross. The question is, what's God doing there? Well, it shows me at least this, that God has not remained distant from the problem of human suffering, but has become part of it. That's number one. Number two is this. Why I have hope and why I actually believe the story I've just told is that death is not the end. If death is the end, as the atheists believe, it's even worse than you say. Because, for example, no victim of terrorism will ever get justice. Hitler can gas 6 million Jews and all kinds of other people as well, then blow his brains out, and by definition, he's got away with it. He's died a little bit earlier. You see, I can see the outrage of the new atheists, but they have no moral basis for it. Let's listen to Richard Dawkins on the foundations of morality for a moment. The universe, he says, is just like we'd expect it to be. If at bottom, there's no good, there's no evil, there's no justice. DNA just is, and we dance to its music. Well, if that's true, there's an end of all morality. Now, it seems to me that a Christian like myself is presented with major problems, but they're nothing like the problems of the atheist.
Yeah, but there's no ought entailed in what Dawkins is saying. He is not saying that because this is the way it is, that's the way it ought to be. That is, he's not making an inference from science to morality. He's simply saying, out of that reality, that bleak reality, we have to construct a morality.
Oh, but just wait a moment. He's saying there is at bottom no justice. The human heart cries for justice. For Dawkins, like Michael Ruse and E.O. Wilson, morality is, I quote, an illusion fobbed off on us by our selfish genes to get us to cooperate. It's much more serious than you're suggesting. He has undermined the whole of morality.
You've explained that in a negative sense. One could equally point that into a positive, though. You could say, look, the power of evolution is that it has begun to help us evolve a moral sense.
Well, I simply see no evidence of that. I think that's falling into the mistake that David Hume pointed out long ago, that you cannot get an ought from an is. And Dawkins has admitted, and I admire him for this, that you can't found morality, particularly the notion of absolute morality, on the basis of science. Einstein said it long ago.
You can base it on human community, though. The existence of human community and recognising that we have to get on together.
Ah, but there's the whole point. We have to get on together.
To survive.
That works very well. This utilitarian philosophy, which is all around the world, really, it works marvellously until I get enough power that I don't care what you do to me, which is exactly where Hitler got. And
indeed,
it doesn't work there.
And at that point, community struck back. It took a lot of effort, but community struck back.
Yes, but
And ultimately, community struck back against Stalin. I mean, you were there when the Berlin Wall fell.
Yes, I was. But look, Stalin had 60 million victims. None of them have had any justice. The notion of justice for them is a complete illusion. I want to dig down much deeper. I don't believe justice is an illusion. And therefore, my Christian teaching tells me that there's going to be a judgment. There's going to be a final accountability.
How much of your explanatory understanding of religion is tied, in fact, to the Christian explanation?
Oh, a great deal.
That is, it's not just about God. It's about a particular understanding of God.
Absolutely, because the God that's produced by an analysis of the universe, as the New Testament itself admits, you can deduce certain things about God. But you see, if God is a person, that raises the question, is it possible to get to know God? So I have evidence coming from the scientific side and also the historical and experiential side. Those are equally important to me. Getting to know God. So I don't stop just with some abstract notion that there's a power out there. How am I related? That's the crucial question.
This is a question that takes us beyond the question of atheism versus theism. It's a question that takes us into belief systems, competing belief systems.
Into historical evidence for which of those belief systems coheres and is true. It's evidence again, I think.
And we'll come back to that in just a moment, because now we're going to have another piece of music which goes to this question of justice in the universe, the chorus of the Hebrew Slaves.
Yes.
Why?
Well, there's something deeply evocative about Verdi's chorus of the Hebrew Slaves, and it just reminds me every time I hear it of the groaning of a suffering humanity, and reminds me of the fact, a very humbling fact, and I think Solzhenitsyn put it so well, the line dividing good and evil cuts through every human heart, including mine. And to be able to stand up in the world and have something to say that will help people who are groaning to make sense of that and give them real hope and not just a tooth fairy fantasy.
Chorus of the Hebrew Slaves. The Music of Verdi on Sunday night. John Cleary with you, our guest, Professor John Lennox. Professor of Mathematics, Fellow in the Philosophy of Science at Oxford University, and he's here in Australia debating the God question. John Lennox, we've spoken about the explanatory power of science. We've spoken about morality and its link with the universe. We're now speaking about the nature of God. That is, you are prepared to say not only is it reasonable to assume that God exists, but it's reasonable to assume there is a particular type to God. That is, it's not the God of the Hindu, it's not the God of the Muslim. This God I worship is distinctly and uniquely embodied in the person of Jesus Christ. Now, that's a step beyond which many involved in this debate simply wouldn't go.
That's correct. And I think we need to distinguish two things. And that is, what I'm not saying is that there are no true insights elsewhere. When you consider the great philosophies and religions of the world, as was pointed out long ago, you'll discover that at the moral level, there are a lot of commonalities. And from where I sit as a Christian, that makes perfect sense, because every one of us, whether we believe in God or not, whether we're atheists, whether we're Hindus, Buddhists, Muslims, we are moral beings. And in fact, that's a very good basis for our being able to live together in society. So I would emphasize that very strongly. Every man and woman, whatever the religion, to my mind, is a person of infinite dignity and worth because they're made in the image of God. Now, if you don't believe in God, that is still a basis. But what we're now talking about is the question of truth and what should I believe and on what evidence. And for me, it is a matter of evidence again. You see, I can't speak for other religions, John. There is blind faith around in the world, and it's very dangerous. I would agree with the new atheists, especially when it's coupled to authoritarianism. But as far as Christianity is concerned, faith is not blind in that sense. It is a response to evidence. I mean, after all, take the book of the New Testament that talks most about it. We've got to look at the documents and what they claim before we discuss it. The Gospel of John, the fourth biography of Jesus, at its end says, many other things Jesus did in the presence of his disciples that are not written in this book, but these are written in order that you might believe. Here's the evidence on which faith can be based. When Paul addressed the philosophers, Epicurean Stoics and others at Athens, he said there's going to be a judgment. God has already appointed the judge. Well, what's the evidence of that? Well, it's the resurrection for all men, not just for believers. So Dawkins gets it completely the wrong way around, which is a very clever ploy. Because if you teach people that faith is believing where there's no evidence, then you don't have to consider any evidence because by definition it doesn't exist. But belief in God and faith in God is not simply faith in a theory about God. It's trust in a person. I would almost abolish the word faith and replace it by what it means, that is trust. Now, I went to Cambridge many years ago, and on my first Sunday there, I saw a beautiful girl. So I took in evidence about her through my eyes, then through my ears, and it built up. And then there came a point where I had to decide, was I going to commit myself to that person? I didn't know everything about her. I didn't know how life would work out. But there was enough evidence there of all kinds, emotional, intellectual, and so on, that I felt you can take that step, not into the dark, but into a relationship that would develop. And I see faith as precisely that. The idea that it's an existential leap is, to my mind, nonsense. Although, of course, when I trusted God first, I didn't know everything. I still don't.
John Lennox, we're almost out of time. You've been very generous with your time with us this evening, but I must ask you one question that hangs upon this. And in some ways it's a side channel, in other ways it's not. This question of faith and evidence bedevils religion in another sense, in that you have those within religion who are so obsessed with proving their religion or proving the Bible that they take science on. That is, they regard themselves as warriors against the conspiracy of science, the conspiracy of Darwinism. I'm talking about creationism.
Now, there seems to be an interesting, I think it was somebody said who actually made the observation that creationism, in fact, is a perversion of science. It is actually using scientific methodology for non-scientific purposes, that there is a confusion of categories going on here. To what extent is this whole debate about creationism that you get out of the United States and that's been in the newspapers from time to time a dangerous diversion for those involved in serious religion?
I think it certainly is a diversion. The problem as I see it is some people are convinced not simply of creationism in the old sense, that is, there is a creator. They feel that the Bible is unequivocal in stating that the age of the earth is very young and so on and so forth. And so the big things get lumped together with the lesser things. And the age of the earth is, for example, virtually made a touchstone of doctrine when there's so much evidence out there in science against it. Now, I myself feel it would lead us into a very long discussion, but the book of Genesis is a bit more sophisticated than some people think. For example, this whole debate runs around the so-called literal meaning of the word day in Genesis 1. But if you look at Genesis 1, you find the word day has four meanings in that text, and they're all different. And when I see a very short text like that, with a word that's used frequently that has different nuanced meanings, I say, hold on a bit. This could be a very sophisticated business. And just an elementary thing, I might point out just one thing here. It says, in the beginning, God created the heaven and the earth. The text doesn't even say that that was on day one. So that, you know, that beginning is, to my mind, uncertain in the past. So I have no difficulty with the scientific view. I think the real problem is, as you say, that it focuses attention away from the main issue and gets into an unnecessary collision with science.
It's a debate, in a sense, about how much you understand about the Bible rather than how much you understand about science. That is, what is the nature of the text?
That's absolutely right. That's absolutely right. I sometimes say, if Genesis didn't talk about those days, what would you believe? You know, and I think that's completely right. I tend to start by thinking about the very fact that Scripture claims there was a beginning. That is a stunning thing because it took science up to the 1960s to get that far, you see. And that gets obscured in this debate. It's skewing it. I respect people who, like myself, believe in the inspiration of Scripture. It's the Word of God. But when you find equally godly, equally intelligent, this is now from a Christian perspective, people who disagree on certain things, they don't disagree on the resurrection of Jesus. They don't disagree on the fact that there was a creation. But when you see them disagreeing on things like the interpretation of the days, I think that is a warning that we need to be less dogmatic and approach it much more humbly and learn to distinguish what are the things about which we can be more certain and what are the things about which we can be less certain?
John Lennox, great to have you on Sunday night. We're going to finish with another selection of yours, and this is from Tchaikovsky, the Piano Concerto No. 1. This is an opportunity for you to tell us about one of the more interesting aspects of your life.
Tchaikovsky, Russian piano. I love the piano. I wish I could play it better than the amateurish way in which I do. Magnificent stuff, but it evokes to me Russia. And I've been to Russia many times, starting in 1989, many visits, first as a guest of the Academy of Sciences. And that was just an utterly enriching time to be out, for example, in Siberia.
And it's a place, of course, where religion has returned with, in all its aspects, good and bad, with something of a vengeance over the last 20 years.
Oh, that's right. There's great interest. I mean, when I first went in 89, I was astonished. Something happened there that would never have happened in the West. You imagine me giving a lecture in the Mass Department at Sydney and a leading, world-leading professor putting his hand up at the end and saying, can we ask you about other questions other than mathematics? And I said, certainly. And he said, we hear you believe in God. Why? That wouldn't happen in Sorbonne or Oxford or Cambridge or Sydney, would it? But I discovered this fascination. How can you possibly be an academic and believe in God? And plenty of people told me I just didn't exist, which, of course, for an Irishman poses absolutely insoluble philosophical problems, as you might realise, you know. But that led me to get in among the dissidents. And that was fascinating. I'll never forget one night being in the home of a brilliant mathematician. And he'd been in the gulag, as many others. And he said, you know, all of you except our guest know that I've been for 40 years a hard atheist. I thought Christianity and religion were for old people and the weak and so on. And tonight I hear in my home arguments I've never heard before, arguments for which I've no answer at the moment. And he turned to me and he said, you must give me time. We haven't even got the conceptual apparatus to process the arguments you're putting across. I find that exceptionally interesting, that communism, with its central atheistic dogma, had simply frozen the intellect. And I would say, you don't believe in God? No. Well, why not? There isn't a God. Well, what's the evidence for that? And they'd suddenly say, what do you mean evidence? Surely you don't believe there's evidence for a God. It that kind of thing. And I find that so instructive. And made many friends in Russia that way.
John Lennox, it's been a privilege to have you with us. Let's enjoy Tchaikovsky, Piano Concerto No. 1. John Lennox, thanks again for joining us.
Thank you very much for inviting me.
You're on Sunday Night on ABC Radio around Australia. John Cleary with you, back after the news with the Inquisition.